Oh.
Come on in.
Hello.
Hello, sister.
I was going to start worrying, did you?
You ain't going to have no kiss. Shame on you.
Well, I'm always good to see you.
And there's David T.
Jesus, right.
Glad to meet you.
This is our good friend, McGee. And you?
Did you get any difficulty in coming through?
No, just took a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, we went off 20 miles one time.
Louise just phoned a while ago. They thought you had
we
some kind.
Oh, dear.
No. So, I guess I was home.
Farewell.
Indian fashion.
Indian fashion.
Indian fashion.
So, how is everything?
Are we really here?
Yeah.
Are we really here? Yeah.
We're really here. Yes, and she phoned me around the door. She had a vision. She thought.
What'd she have?
Well, just a purse. And that's what we. She can actually see the blue inscription on the purse. So she was looking at the board, one of the few folks in the right, or left, or left.
No.
I said no, but that wouldn't worry. It's good to see you soon.
It goes without saying, it's good to see you.
Not a whole lot, but maybe.
Oh, we promised the others we'd bring them.
Yeah, we said we'd bring them
to get together and meditate and then meditate again Friday night.
It was funny, you know, they said that when the rain will stop to work, and whole day it rained like mad till this afternoon. Went back to work. It was interesting how it poured and poured like rain.
And it's been beautiful weather coming.
Gosh. Right. You gotta clean up the air. But how is it?
I'm going to tell you like Marlowe said. You asked me how his meditation was going. You should know.
I said it's going great. David and I both had a great experience. It would be Tuesday morning, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So I'd say meditation's going great. Right.
That's what Mia Farwell said. You know, she went studying the Maharishi.
He's coming to Dallas, they say.
Well, you're entitled. Go, prepare yourself, you'll get more.
Now, you see,
the whole thing is, each one of us is like a little spark. Then as the spark gets bigger by exposure to other sparks, before you know it, it becomes like a flame. Now, eight or 10 years ago, I don't think anyone would be ready for this man. They wouldn't comprehend what they were trying to teach. But then again, you need a sort of a movement prior to their presence or prior to their coming to sort of lay the groundwork, lay sort of a challenge in ourselves. So we had what you call a beatnik movement, we had the hippie movement, and now we have what is called a gelling of this consciousness. We find all the students in different universities are all reaching out to really explore themselves in the first time. Well, as long as you have these men living and demonstrating this capacity of, you find it, being exposed to that particular prior movement, you have something now to compare. Before, you would have nothing to compare. See? Like, and Marlowe once, I don't know if you folks know Marlowe, he had something to compare between meditation and going to an Indian meditation and a reservation. And for the first time when he was exposed to it, he saw what meditation was. And then after he saw that, then he had something else again to compare. He saw how to go past that. Before he met the Indians in the reservation, in their way of meditation, it was all book in the mind. You know? Then the little experience of meditating together. Then he went to the Indian meeting in the reservation and he saw the two. First it was a struggle to sit down for 10 minutes. Then the first meeting, you know. Then the exposure to from 8 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning, everybody's sitting down trying to meditate on the reservation, you know. You can imagine a tremendous battle. Let alone sit down for 10 minutes in your own home. Here these people come in the middle of the night, you know. Let's strike up a meeting right away. Don't go to a meeting right now, they got a meeting going on. They have a whole meeting going at night, you know. So this is a struggle for Marlon. Then after that, he's able to compare. And then, I guess when he met Ananda Moore, you know, this is shot Ananda Moore questions to get going. Well, I think he sits down to meditate for an hour or two.
Marlon?
Yeah, he meditated. Yes, well, the thing is this, you see. Since he was training to be a Jesuit monk before he met him, you see, the monks have a form of preparation to organize their mind by, I don't know, that's why they have in these monasteries little yards. They walk up and down, walk and forth. You see them pacing the yard. This is actually to bring the mind to concentrate. Didn't know why, you know. They're doing it as a sort of a rote system. It's not really understanding why they're doing it. Then you find that they make yourself comfortable. They have a sort of a practice in which they try to focus their mind. So he was doing this as a monk, and he was training as a monk, and then all of a sudden he got sick, couldn't go any further. And then he came out from the monastery. But he was still searching for something. He did not know why he was searching. Eventually, you see, became exposed to the understanding of self within. Then he started to see the relationship. The time I met him, the first was a struggle to meditate. And then all of a sudden to be exposed to people who live on a reservation. For hours they're meditating, this is quite a shock to the mind, you know? And then come back and evaluate, compare, they're ready to practice themselves. You see, he had three comparisons. And this is very good for him. One, he had the comparison of walking up and down because he was forced into it as a kid. And he lived in an environment because to satisfy the parent, you know. This is one good comparison. And then in God's city came out. I kept searching. Then all of a sudden he runs into us. Our system is strictly to sit down and calm the mind. Well, this is a new thing because it's not so easy to do. Then he runs into the exposure of people on the reservation who resort to a psychedelic process, which is peyote. And they resort to a psychedelic process to enter the state. Now, he has something to compare, but having no knowledge of what really occurs inside, he was handicapped to compare. See, with all his intellectual book learning, he had no way to compare what really went on because he never did practice meditation from within. It was only meditation from the book. You understand? What really occurs inside is a different thing altogether. You have to shut all that out and really get inside. Well, from that exposure, to see these people really acquiring some peace of mind, without really getting to what they're going after. And then he saw the devotion. He saw the simplicity. But at the same time, he saw the disadvantage. But he didn't recognize the disadvantage. The disadvantage was that although these people were achieving a sort of extrasensory awareness, it was not staying with them in a permanent state. They were not able to hold on to this thing after they came out from their meetings. And it's Sunday morning, everybody greet each other, brother and sister, and you take off, and then the thing is finished. You have to go back next Sunday. So you realize that this thing is not staying with you. You have to keep this thing going. Then you start starting to rely more on an external agent. And there is no volitional control now. You are not employing your will. You see, there is no real concentration. This is the challenge, because the will is the real thing you're after. You have to develop the will, and without it, there is no real control. Like the morning and after the first meditation, I just go back and meditate, and just stay there till the will push you out, right? Now, from the experience, you see now that the will is the thing. Until you get hold of the will and let it organize it, then intuition follows that. You see, that is why you would understand the symbology of why Peter wanted to be crucified upside down. No one really understands that symbolism in Peter's life. See, Jesus is a symbolism of pure intuition, direct perception from within oneself, free from repercussion of thinking, which is called the Christ state in man. Everyone strives for it. He strives to realize himself, which it means attain, or attainment, or illumination. Now, Peter was a demonstration of dogged will. Upon this rock I will build my church. It is upon consecrated will that intuitive consciousness has an opportunity to regulate life outwardly before it can regulate it inwardly. You have nothing else to regulate, you see. You cannot regulate it by sheer feeling. You have to regulate it by will, and this is why it says upon this rock. It's upon this fact that the will governs everything. Now, but not ego will. It is the universal will in things. That is, the dynamic pull of life on you that holds you up together. That's why the scriptures would say, there is no thing in this universe that can move except by divine will. So there is no portion of our mechanism as a human being that can exert some form of movement or control except this will version. Now, will is a combination of desire plus energy. You must have some desire, so intense desire, and you must generate some form of energy because you are an example, a living model of consciousness and congealed energy to form matter. But the trick of it, what we call Maya, or the relativity of it, is how to recognize it. And the only way you can recognize this is when you stop the feeling, the pull of the feeling, and watch at it. And then you realize, if this person is agitating you or aggravating you, come, let's go out and have a Coke, let's go to hamburger, let's go do this. And you say, no, I want to stay here, I want to stay here. You don't do it from a sheer because you want to be stubborn. You want to bring the mind back to holy. But then you find gradually it will obey. But you can go and have that and have that, you still come back. That's why Jesus will say, it's not what you eat that will defy you, what comes out of you. It is not so much that you don't involve yourself with your feeling. It's the fact that you may lose your ability to regulate your will through your feeling. See? If you have the power to regulate your will, you control feeling. But if you don't have this power, then feeling regulates you. And this is what we don't want to develop in the early stages of our growth. We want to develop will first in order that the pure feeling, the true feeling, eventually you're going to arrive at pure feeling, which is pure consciousness. But this pure consciousness, pure feeling, is something that only comes out after the will is developed. Now, as I said, Peter preferred to die upside down. Now, this is a reason. Will, eventually, when it's developed, contains a certain percent of ego in it. It is never free, totally, from the ego. Because remember, it requires a certain desire pattern to drive it. It has to have this desire pattern to drive it, otherwise it would never move. This wouldn't move from here to here unless you have a desire. You see? But because you're involved as an individual with the desire, you're involved with ego. You see? Now, if you feel the thing and say, now, move without exerting physical energy, then this thing will move too. That is proving now the power of telekinesis, which at the same time is to prove, if you have faith in me, in a greater mustard seed, you see unto the shoot move, or you see unto the mountain move, and the mountain will move. But this is a law unto itself to understand how will can be free from ego. Most of the time, a great portion of our existence, will is involved with ego. Until we surrender this will and accept divine will, that's why you find all the great masters will say, not my will, but the cosmic will be done. Not my will, but thy will be done, or the Father's will be done. In other words, as long as there is ego in the will, intuition never have a chance to control our life. But as soon as we surrender this will, and that's where the word discipline comes in, there the word, that's where the feeling of obedience comes in, the first law of existence. As soon as we surrender it, it takes a great challenge because it's not so easy. It's too involved with the material body, too involved with desire, it's too involved with personal likes and dislikes to surrender right away. You know what I mean? That doesn't say that you should not surrender it, but it doesn't say that you totally throw everything away just to fulfill the surrender. Surrender is something that comes naturally. You naturally feel this thing leaving you. You will naturally feel the desire and the ego leaving your will. It's a funny phenomenon. It comes on its own. And you cannot feel that on the drugs. But what you will feel on the drugs is a suspension. It's sort of I'm a helpless being. Stick me to the hypodermic and the pain don't exist no more. So volition is shut down. It's sort of a semi-paralysis of the organs. But then as soon as this wears away, back comes the condition. But when this suspension of will comes in, it is like the surgeon has taken a cosmic syringe now and stuck you with some kind of energy in there that it totally cauterizes everything and it'll never come back no more. It's just totally shut off. No matter how you try, it's like it's all cut out. It's like somebody cut it out all out of your system and you are free. This is a different thing altogether. This comes strictly from your meditation. So it is like being turned upside down all of a sudden within yourself. You're no longer pushing with your head, you know, to do things. In other words, you're relaxing and everything is being done for you. Strange thing. Everything is turned around for you for the first time. You begin to recognize everything is falling into place. And this is the realization, is when you recognize things are falling in their place for you, without even applying too much effort. That's what you see. Now the divine will is moving your life. Yeah. So you have actually performed symbolically within yourself the truth of the upside down crucifixion of Peter. The cauterizing of will and allowing intuition or Christness to come into you. Flows, you know. So, strange that not until that occurs in us can we be free. It is, and yet we need will. It's strange, there's a paradox. We need will so much to enforce a certain level of understanding, and after you arrive at this level, we have to tear it all down to get another level of understanding. You say, why don't we start right from the beginning this way? You see? And get it. And then the great masters will say, but you have nothing to compare with, how would you know? So climb up the hill, slip down back on your knees, before you get to the bottom, somebody will pick you up and brush you off and take you up to the top again. And that's what the masters are for, exactly. They want us to skid up and bruise up and get scarred up by the time we get to the top, you know. And the last one, oh man, is there a master somewhere to help me pull me out of this to the level? And this world is all crashing in on me. Well, let's crash. It's a funny phenomenon. You can't really crash. You never really crash. It won't really crash in us, or the feeling that we are crashing is that inwardly we see the futility or feel the futility of struggling. We don't know why. This is one of the peculiar things of our consciousness. Not to know what you are doing or why you're doing it builds up such a tremendous anxiety. You know, it's like automatically we are starting to collapse. You know, that's really where the core of the fear exists. There really is no fear, or really no reason to fear. It is the unknown quantity, X, that keeps us agitated. Why we're struggling and we're not getting results. Why? We don't realize that actually we are only living. It's like a seed growing. Why can't I eat a tomato right away when I plant it? Why I have to wait so many days before it grows? Eat it. See? Now, why can't I do this right away? Well, the masters will tell you can't, because in mastery, the first thing it takes only sometimes lies to, sometimes many incarnations even to get past a certain point. And yet, through intercession and many little virtues, they can pull you up your point. So you ask yourself, is it worth it? The question is not if it is worth it, The question is, can I stick it out? It's not that it's worth it, that's important. Can I stick it out? What really is? Am I trying to stick out in the first place? I'm only trying to stick out the value of life as a human being, consciously. You see, none of us would be aware of the true nature of our existence consciously if we were never exposed to it through another human being. Now, I think Emerson says, if the moment I get out in nature, nature herself makes a Brahmin out of me. In other words, the mere fact of the magnitude of creation, wherever you are, makes you feel so small, shrink you down so much, that you begin to think of, why should I go back into that hustle-bustle out there for a lousy few bucks a week, and I just sit back here and enjoy all the beauty of trees. Well, then you start to see that quality come again. Then the masters will say, yes, that is true. It's good. But that is only one portion of the evolution that you need. Then you find out, what is the other portion? The other portion of my evolution is, I get back in the hustle and bustle, and under the stresses and strain of everyday living, this consciousness is working through the rhythm. I'm tugging, you know? But you are proving now, without exerting too much effort, the laws of life are responding around you. And you are proving now the other half of your nature, that the universe was made for man and not man for the universe. You have no opportunity to prove that to yourself unless you live with people. The saint knows that. The great masters know that. That's why they get back with people. They first find themselves in solitude, then they get involved with people, because this is where they have to live out the other half of their nature. Now, if the universe was not made for man, and let's say man was made for this universe, then none of us need to meditate. And I'll show you why the universe was made for man and not man for the universe. If man was the first act of creation, then man would have to do his own creation of trees, animals to entertain himself or feed himself. He'd have to create a planet to live on. He'd have to create his own atmosphere to survive. He'd have to create his own moon to give him light. And he'd have to create his own sun to sustain the life. But if you look at it, man was the last act of creation. Every other thing came first before man, so everything was made for man. So man is an important creature. He transcends everything, because if everything was made for you, then you are an heir. My father and my mother, in their own consciousness, would say, we have to have a son or a daughter. So we're going to get married, and they prepare, and they can try and save some money, build up a business, and when we get old and so, we can leave all this for our son, and that he may have a better life. And just throw ourselves back to the year 1760, somewhere in Europe, under the persecution of different tyrannical moves. And there's a great country across the ocean called, what do you call it? Oh, the Red Man Land. Yeah, America. Just discovered by some Spaniard I hear from Genoa. Columbus, they're calling? Yeah. I think honey, that's the land of promise. The streets are lined with gold, I hear. Let us go. Here is two bright-eyed people in their early 20s, and they see this glorious vision. They grasp it. But who are they grasping for? They're grasping for the offspring to have something better than them. That is the same principle applying back into nature. What is this creator creating this universe for? It's in order that he could revel or have magnification in a human body. He has no other opportunity. Otherwise, If we were living in the pure etheric body, we wouldn't choose this specific planet with all the blight and sickness to come and exist in it. With all the problems we'd go on some other beautiful planet. But it is a great challenge. This great intelligence puts us in this physical body to try it out the experiences if we need it. As the one student asked one of the masters one time, "Master, why are we getting all these UFOs and different things?" And the master says, "Well, they are coming here, we are going there, that's all." He says, "But it's been going on long before you come to recognize it as a UFO." So, it never ceased to wonder. Now, the thing is, we're talking about will, you know. One of the greatest truths of this will is, well, look at it this way. The masters are really, in a sense, masters of life engineering. Now remember, Jesus never taught Christianity. Buddha never taught Buddhism. Muhammad never taught Mohammedism. You think Confucius never taught Confucianism. Lao Tzu never taught Lao Tzuism, what do you want to call it, Taoism. Yet, all these masters, even Nanak and all the modern day masters, all teach one basic truth. Funny thing, they all have one common thread of knowledge. Yet when the student picks up that thread, from wherever he comes from, right away that thread is classified by the teacher's name. And then the thread of truth is lost again in Dhamma, in organization. Then somebody starts a new revivalism. And this is the universal law of life. That truth is exposed occasionally, periodically, in its pure sense, by the human form. And then by the human form, it is adulterated, so that the human form will come back to establish it. Like the Krishna, I'll come again and again to renew the right of life. Unless we can understand that, it's like Jesus says, everyone is expecting a second coming of Jesus. They don't realize what the man is saying in the first place. The Master Jesus came already in a physical form, illustrating in his body form among a particular group of people of a particular culture the qualifications of masterhood. Yet he was not fully recognized in it. In fact, one master went to say, "You only had 12 disciples, what a poor collection for a master, only 12, not to be recognized by his people." But it's not numbers we're looking at. And in fact, out of the 12 didn't even get the realization until he left the body. The one who was not even a disciple got the realization from the master. And this is the oddest thing. There were so many different things that he did that people couldn't understand it. But to really appreciate the Master Jesus is when you start meditating, you start to see the whole picture of your life. Then you start to see the impact of what the Master Jesus was doing. He was a master of life engineering. Today doctors are going into little bits of it. You want to give it new names. They have one little facet to give it a new name. Biology, physiology, psychologies. None of us know how to practice phlegmology. You know, the poor Philip. You ever heard the story of the philosopher that went into the boat and the boatman? Right. Is a philosophy versus swimology. We do not know how to swim the river of life through conscious feeling and conscious will. We were therefore, we are stuck in the mud of resistance. That's actually where we are. We're stuck in the mud of resistance. We're constantly battling. Yet if we can swim through it, we're free. And this is what the masters of life are teaching us. Life engineering, or divine life, is the art of behavior. If you have this art permeated you, you can swim this thing. Because you're moving from one aspect of life to a higher aspect of life. But you're not going any place in the sense of the word that you're going to some place, you know. The only real place you're going is here, H-E-R-E. And the only real feeling is N-O-W. And the only true action is joy, aliveness. The fact you're alive, you know, and everything has texture. You can actually smell it. You can reach out and squeeze it. You look at everything, it seems to pulsate. And then you know, I am alive. I'm a being. I'm not a dead rock.
A nano. These two sign. And the brain is just going like this the whole way.
But this
it
is
was
alive.
Great.
This right? is the living feeling. You see, first it's feeling. And then that type of feeling slowly dissolves into will. And that will dissolves eventually into the pure feeling. You see, feeling in the early stages does not produce or make you conscious of texture in things. You will not be aware of the texture of things, true vision, or true, this mere fact of sensing it, that it's pulsating. But then comes the will, because you want to break that shell. You want to be little, you don't want to be pushed, so all of a sudden you find you're withdrawing. The solitude, that's the focusing, the controlling of will now. You're drawn to develop this will. And then this will starts to get agitated to a point though, between what you want to do and what somebody wants you to do. And then you make a break. And then you finally, you come to a point where the feeling actually comes back now. And when it comes back this trip, you start to see now. Actually, you begin to see texture. You actually feel texture. The funny thing, you can taste texture. Everything is that texturized in life. It's pulsating, as if you can actually inhale it too. Then you know you are experiencing true experience of that statement that the Master Jesus said, I don't mean Jesus now, I have come. Self-awareness is approaching its full expression through you, that you may have life more abundantly. Self-awareness is opening up in you for you to experience the reality of life vibrating around you fully for the first time. You are really alive, you know. It's alive to the point of bursting. And there is no boundary lines now for this feeling. And the Maharishi, if you ever want to meet him, he's bursting with joy. You know, the mere fact he is alive, the joy of living. There's the anandam, you know. It's existence, pure consciousness. Well, what is it for? If you exist and if you're aware of your existence, you don't want grief. You don't want anxiety. You want joy. But joy is aliveness. Joy is now and here. Whatever you're doing, no matter what it is, you're doing it with the fullness of joy. You see, in other words, you are building up a bank account of joy. Your own personal bank account of joy. Every day you put a little penny of joy inside it, keep building up. And building up to the point it's just bursting out. Everybody just feel it going through them, you know. They just vibrate like a sort of a giant washing machine agitator. Everybody gets agitated with this joy. And then you understand now why the early fathers of democracy in this country said the pursuit of happiness. But pursuit is quite a little off in its nature, because you can be pursuing happiness and still not catch up with it. You see? And then the race becomes only the race. It's not really the realization of the race. It is more of the understanding happiness than the pursuit of happiness. See, pursuit is like you're chasing something that you're never going to catch, or something that is eluding you. You see? In hot pursuit of the sheriff behind the gangster, the posse is in hot pursuit. It's chasing something. It's more of the understanding of your nature than happiness. You know, today's songs are being formed. Happiness is a brand new Cadillac. Happiness is this. But happiness is. Truly, you go back to the poet who said, happiness is nowhere to be found but in a contented mind. But again, we start to see that that is not true in its real nature. Because when you have to live that experience, you'll find out it's slightly off as a feeling. Happiness exists as a feeling in the contents of mind. Because you don't know what mind is. You use mind to perceive. And when you perceive, you retain the perceptions or the things perceived in that reservoir of mind. And it's out of those retained experiences you get the happiness from. Because you have to relive them constantly. So people say, I relive certain memories. Some are good, some are unpleasant. The unpleasant ones, well, after a while they cease to be unpleasant. They all become good memories. So we learned that was a good show. It was a good movie. Why did I ever fall from a tall chair and come down on my back? That was a good show. Why did it happen? It was misery. You know what I mean? But then you look, this is, and then you say, what? Then you start to see where happiness really is. Happiness is the fact that you can look backwards into one's own reservoir of experience and see the relationships. See, now, there's nothing there because to be afraid of, there's nothing there to resent in the first place. What is happening into the physical body at the moment, the shock, there is the resentment, there is the fear, there is all the aggravation. Yet when the period passes on, you start to see there is no such thing. It's pure happiness all the time. Now again in the scriptures, they say all these things come to pass. But they left out one statement. Yes, all these things will come to pass in your life, but not to stay. They don't stay. Can you recall of any memory that is keep staying with you? Of an experience? Let's say you have an automobile accident. Is it going to stay with you all the time? It's going to stop sometime that you're going to live with it. You've got to sleep sometime. Right? Okay, you have a brand new article, it falls on a break. But sometime you got to sleep until it's going to pass out of consciousness. Till you wake up again, and then you start activating it. But every time it passes out, it's gone, temporarily suspended, till it wears off the effect. Oh boy, look at that. Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Oh, Kim, we don't want to forget the book.
Please. Oh, yeah. I have it. Louise wanted me to give you this book.
Thank you, the Hebrew goddess. Yeah. But, yeah. Jeez.
There's some questions in from my mother. Yeah, she wrote none.
Then or where?
In the book.
In the book? Yes, yes. Okay.
We ask questions by proxy.
Good. Anyway, that's how Sabine says boy, eh?
Yes, absolutely.
Sita. Ram, ram, Sita, ram. See? Ram, or Rama, was the personification of God in man as the ideal husband. And Sita, the personification of God in woman as the ideal wife. And I think that the part of the Ramayana which showed this ideal relationship was when they were in exile. She said to him, "Permit me, Lord, to walk ahead of you, to clear the path of thorns, to rub thy feet, so that I may glean the glow of thine eyes." Now, imagine what this woman would have to do for her husband. To clear the path of thorns, she'd have to walk on them first. This is quite a challenge. And the ideal husband part was, he saw she was abducted. And there was no stone unturned that he did not try to find her back. Then the last minute, with all this being accomplished, he was in doubt in his mind. As when he returned from the battle and he got his wife back, he was always worrying, was she a faithful woman? This is a peculiar nature in man too. And he had to overcome this. And in that woman chose trial by ordeal. You ever heard of trial by ordeal? To prove her love for her husband. On two occasions she chose fire. And walked unharmed through the fire to prove her love for the gentleman. And on the third occasion, she chose the earth. There's where the word furrow, F-U-R-R-O, comes from. Sita, the furrow. She returned from the furrow where she came from. She walked into the earth, and Mahakali, the earth, opened up to accept her. And instead of the earth remaining open for her to walk down, so her husband can see. She looked at her husband and smiled, and she called the other to come back over there. And from that day on, he realized that the sacrifice of the woman's love was so great that he was able then to break what is called the last vestige of doubt in his mind after the Trinity. So the Ramayana is a very great book if you can understand what is written in it. It is a great, not only from the standpoint of the epic, the standpoint of the hidden laws that are written in it. See, Sita is never born of man or woman. Sita was the result of seven drops of blood from seven great rishis. And she was the adopted daughter of King Janaka.
Thank you.
Okay, got a little glass.
Here we go. Stick it.
Randy.
You see, there is a chant that goes Ram, Ram, Sita Ram, 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 Sita Ram. And all throughout India, they keep chanting this. Ram, in its ideal state, is God in man, as the ideal husband. Sita, the ideal state is woman, ideal wife. This is what's very great truth. And you never hear the word Ram, Sita, Ram. I said it like that before, right? But the chant is Sita, Ram, Sita, Ram, Sita, Ram. It's always Sita first before Ram. As I said in the story, I'll go before my Lord and play the part of thorns and rub his feet with a gleam of light that shines into my heart. The chant is Sita Ram, Ram, Sita Ram. Sita, being in the fur, you know, and as I said, well, she was never born of like a man or in the manner we know of being born. There was a, wherever you get the book of the Ramayana, you read it. It has many hidden things about it, it's not written about it. There was a king, his name was Janaka, and he lived with his wife, just like Abraham and his wife, you know, she had been told, you know, in old age before he got Isaac as a son. That also has a great symbology. It's a symbology of the origin of a certain truth pertaining to the soul. And Janak found one day his land was all being decimated, dried up. The cows are dying, everything is dying. And he was a fully realized man too. Kingdom, because he was the guru of the son of Vyas Muni, the author of your Bhagavad Gita, and the son's name was Sakuntala. But that was after this king Janak. He was saw all this thing happening to his country and couldn't figure it out. He called in his wise men, and they all told him, "No." The only way you can stop this is your rival king has done this to you. Since you have exacted so much tribute from your people, one of these lower chieftains decided to pay you back in kind. And to pay you back in kind, he went out to collect taxes from everyone in his region. And he taxed the people from the forest, the rishis. So Janak was quite surprised. How did he tax? How did this chieftain go and tax these cheap rishis? Well, these hermits, they don't earn money, so they have no money to give. But this chieftain had to have something to give to his overlord because he has to pay taxes. So there were seven of them And each one decided, well, their only possession that was of value, that they could surrender to such an overlord, was a drop of blood. This is a valuable possession. It's more valuable than this. One drop of blood is a valuable thing, especially in a realized man's body. Because that blood has certain powers in it. And or a woman. So they extracted one drop of blood, put it in another vial. Seven drops. Here's this chieftain. And then this chieftain realized what he had done, because his wise men also told him, he said, you better get rid of that vial, because you are cursed for the balance of your life. You'll never go straight no more. So he took the vial and buried it in Janak's region. And from then on, everything started to die out. Because you took life from the living masters as tribute to live. This force works the karma back on you. If you're that greedy to take blood out of stone, now these men were like stone then, or what you call spiritual stone, this force will work back on them. So the force started, everything started to die to keep these people alive. In other words, their blood was the only thing that kept them alive. And if they had to give it up as taxes, then something had to give up itself for them to exist as spiritual people. As you say, if you cut the tongues off of men of peace, the stones themselves should start shouting peace. Well, this is a law that's going on. So everything started to die in relation to what they were giving up. Because you give up one drop of blood, you're dying that much in life relationship. This is a very deep law. So when these things occurred in his region, his wise man told him that the only way he can stop this is that he and his wife had to plow the field like a farmer. And the army was being routed, and the axle of the chariot in which the king was escaping with broke at the edge of the wheel. And this nurse, in order to help her king to escape from being slaughtered by the enemy, pushed her hand through the wheel, the hub of the wheel, and held the axle and used her wrist for the wheel to rotate on. And the horses kept dragging her for miles and miles to save this injury. She was already torn up this, but she still had a beauty on her face. And to reward her for saving his life, he says, name three boons anytime, it's yours. She says, well, my lord, I want... No, he said, name any boon, and it's yours. She said, my lord, I only want three things from you. The first and the second I'll take now. The last I'll take when the time comes. So, okay, what is it? The first, I'd like to have a son from you, or a child from you. That's all right. That's the king. The second, I'd like to be a palace, a place where I can live. That's all right. This, as a king, he could have done. He did that. The third, he couldn't figure what she would ask for in the third place, but she never did ask for it. She just asked for the first two. She got her wish with a boy, and his name was Bharat. That's how India became, was called Bharata after. We call India today Bharat. See, Ayodhya used to be the original name of India, the land of Ayodhya. Now it's called Bharata by the Indians. That is like Ishmael and Abraham, Isaac, you know. The Arabs has got all the oil, and the Jews have built like a sore thumb in Palestine. And this is exactly what this is a peculiar law of life goes on. But she claimed her boon, and when the child was born, it was called Bharat. He was a half-brother to Ram and Lakshman, who were the natural children of the king. When the king was hunting one day, that's the boy, these two boys' father. He loved to hunt, just the sheer sake of hunting. You know, man is the only creature that kills for sport, he doesn't kill to eat. So he was out hunting, and he shot an arrow in the air, and the arrow hit someone by mistake who was filling water. And it happened to be a young boy. And he was so grieved to know he hit a human being and not, he thought it was a deer or something, it had to be a young boy hit. And he picked up the boy, and the boy was dying already. And he asked him where was his folks, and at least try and make some recompense to them. Then he brought up to the folks who were two blind people. They were blind already. And he tried to break the news to them that their son was dead. Well, the grief was so great, the mother immediately died from the shock. The father, he said to him, the king, he said, you have taken our eyes and our hands and our feet and our mouth and our bodies away from us. What have we got left? May you die the same way when you pass on this, so you have nothing, you blind like us. And he fell over and died. And the king was shocked. And all his life, he never paid any attention. Just he was getting about to the point where in his 50s or 60s. He was about to appoint a prince regent to govern the land and give over the reins of government. And he was going blind. Just then, the chariot drove up and his wife, this army nurse, stepped up with her whole group of courtiers came up to see her husband. Then she said to him, I come to claim my third boon. So he said, what can I do? He's already blind, right? He's not completely blind. I want my son to be nominated as Prince Regent. He became instantly blind from the shock. He said, you, of all people, this moment, when my own natural ears I have not even considered, got blind. And then she said, if you don't, I would tell the whole world that you are no man of your word. Well, he was a king. He had to fulfill his word. He gave his word. She saved his life. He said, it's done. She says, on one condition is done, that your own legitimate children will be banished for life from this place. They cannot live here no more. He says, that cannot be. He says, it has to be. And called in the two sons. He told them that their mother, their stepmother, these were the demands of the stepmother and the stepdad. Now when the stepbrother heard the news from, you know, he got the news that his mother had gone this. He who didn't want no throne, he wanted to go with his two other brothers. They were like fire, you know, a tree like fire, and the mother's like water. Now they all wanted to beat the mother up, but anyway, Rama stepped in and said, no, we must obey the wishes of our father. He made his vows, and this is it. We will go into exile. And he and his wife, Sita, and the younger brother, they then took off into exile. And Bharat became the prince regent. And the king died not seeing anybody. He lost everything. Well, coming back to how this law plays back on one. As I said, Rama won his wife by certain forces, and the same force plays itself back on. While they were living in the woods, because they were had to be abandoned, they went to live in the woods, the forests, not the forest people. He built a house and he did certain mantras around the house and told his wife not to leave the house. He had a premonition that Ravana would try to do something. Well, Ravana could not come to actually kidnap her under this protective force. He had to use some kind of trickery. So he caused his whole body to appear as a beautiful there, with studded horns of diamond and gold tip, and caused the hide to be like a psychedelic color, to entice Sita. When she saw that deer run across the woods, she said, "Oh, I have to have that. You know, beauty attracts." And the husband said, "That is no deer. That's just an illusion." She says, no, that's a deer. I just got to go and get it." Well, the husband had realized that this was some trick of Ravana, but he couldn't convince her. Anyway, he went after the deer with his younger brother. While they're searching for the deer, Ravana imitated the younger brother's voice as if he was wounded. And Rama, knowing that his younger brother being wounded would be his responsibility, how could he come back to his father and tell him that he had neglected to protect his younger brother? He didn't see his father die. He didn't know his father died. Then they were banished, you know, because... Anyway, he ran into the woods looking for his younger brother. Just then, Ravana appeared right in front of the house as a begging hermit with a beautiful gold, another hand bowl that they have, the brass bowl, food, but this one is gold. And he said to the lady of the house, "You have a poor beggar something to eat." Well, she was that far, the mantram that was drawn around the house, let's say the protective force was up to here, and Rama had told his wife, "Never step beyond these mantrams. No force outside can catch you." And he was standing right here. He couldn't step across to the house. He couldn't, so he held at the front and he said, "Well, she's seeing him as a poor beggar, wanting a little food or fruit or something." She moved around the house, naturally. And she stepped across. As soon as her foot stepped over the mantram, he revealed himself to her right away. He stood up erect with Prince Ravana. He just snatched her, got hold of his horse and took off. Well, he lived in a city called Lanka, which is known as Ceylon today. And he was known as Prince Ravana of Ceylon, or Lanka, the city of the seven palaces. They were all built in the seven cones. And between India to Ceylon, there's a sort of a causeway built by rocks. It's long been washed away now, but it was a causeway connecting. When Ramak returned home, he saw his wife and he realized what had happened. He saw the mantrams were broken. He realized. So he had to go and seek aid now to go and get his wife back. The ideal wife, the ideal home. But then he realized he's been paid back in kind now. He couldn't resort to no psychic force. He had to earn his way back. He had to go by the natural methods now. So he sought the help of Hanuman, the prince of the monkeys. See, man don't go seek help now from his fellow man, because he lose faith in his fellow man, he goes seek help in the animals. That's why they say Hanuman, the monkey god. Where they draw Hanuman with his face like a monkey, you know. Actually, the idea was that man eventually will turn to the animals to help him after he had lost faith in human beings. You see, like our friend Walt Whitman would say, "I can look at animals for hours and hours and enjoy their being, for they do not hate their kind, they do not condemn their kind, they do not pray to no unseen God for some good crumb that fall before them. At least they're not hypocrites to themselves." So he was glad to look at animals. Well, this is true. Rama went to seek the help of the monkeys, and Hanuman was a representation of the monkeys. Well, the monkey is the closest thing man has as being intelligent. The ape, you know, because it's like Tarzan and the apes, you know. See where Mr. Riceboro's got his idea, you know. So Hanuman found out where the barricade where Sita was kept by the Prince Ravana in the palace. And in order to help Rama, he decided to attract the attention of the people. Well, they say in a monkey, they know a monkey is mischief, and anything, the moment you catch hold of a monkey, you gotta get rid of it. So, he told the people, if they would tie a rag around his tail and pin cans and light it, that will get rid of him. So the people got the monkey, they tied a rag around his tail and pin cans. Cans, you know, little brass things. Those didn't have tins and lobsters to keep a noise and jangling and light. But the monkey was smart. As soon as it did that, it jumped on the rooftop of the house, and the house was made out of trash. It dashed out, and all the houses got up in flames to cause a distraction so that Rama and his friends could come in and get down to Sita. Well, not counting on the fact that this will lead to a war now, because it was an outright declared war between Rama and Ravana. Ravana representing the evil force, and Rama representing the good force. That's how it eventually broke down to what it was meaning, that the idealism had to face guile in some form in order to prove itself by natural methods. If you have an ideal to live for, you will always be confronted with some form of guile to trick you. It make your ideal appear as ridiculous, you know, and not so real, until you can demonstrate the genuineness of your nature, that your ideal is real, and then you have defeated all form of guile. This is what you're really trying to prove to yourself, that you can defeat guile by being natural, by being very real and idealistic in this natural state, and not in an unnatural state, and not in a distorted state, that you can really overcome this guile concept. Well, Ravana had several brothers, and they were all in charge of the war council. And when they started to debate how they will fight Rama and his brother and his people, one brother, his name was Bhishma, or Bhima, some people pronounce it Bhima, he got up and said, "No, I cannot join you, although you be my elder brother, in this battle against the Prince Rama." Yet the Lord Bhima was a great master of creating a smoke screen with his mind. This is how you'd fight. You'd go to fight, and as soon as opponent approaches him, he'll cause a smoke screen by his mind, and the opponent would never see him, you know, who he's fighting. Before, you know, he destroyed the opponent. And before he went out to fight, he told his brother, he says, "You never do this for him, even though he's a brother." He says, "You've done a wrong already." And the brother says, "I'm still head of this house, and you obey him." Well, normally in those countries, in those times, the elder one is always the one who carried it along. He said, "I'm doing this against my better judgment, and may God be my judge." Well, he fought many of Rama's friends and defeated them. And every time he came to fight Rama, he would avoid the issue. Well, one night he crept over to the camp of Rama's camp, and he told Rama, he revealed himself who he was, and he told Rama, he said, "There's only one way to beat my brother. You cannot win him. He has every trick in the book to deceive him, and you will never win this battle. There is only one way, and it's to know his secret." He says, "You both prayed to the divine principle at 7 o'clock in the morning. And the divine principle is non-biased. The one with the greater devotion is the one that gets the greater influx of this principle. So, you being a man of of idealism, I might have brought up being a man of pure guile. Each one has a desire. One to out-trick and one to uphold. So, which one of you will have the greatest devotion tomorrow morning will outdo the other? Well, he says, but in the meantime, if you fail in your devotion, I will be at a certain gate to let you into where my brother is praying. And while he's in the midst of his prayer, it could be only the goddess descending that will cause him to leave that spot under his meditation to get up and talk. He said, that's the time to challenge him to fight. Well, this is the proof of the devotion. While Ravana was preparing his meditation, you know, sitting down, he's trying to meditate to focus his mind. Well, this is a little, I jumped the story, what happened. Before this happened, Ravana had shot an arrow and it hit the kneecap of Lakshman, the younger brother of Rama, and he started to die. Well, this arrow was built in with certain psychic forces in it. And Rama tried to, all his psychic forces, spiritual forces, to stop it, but he only can stop it to a certain extent, then it will start to expand. Then he called in a bhikkhu, a priest, doctor, and asked him, what can we do to save his brother's life? So his brother, he told him, he says, there's only one herb. It's called the leaf of life. It grows on a tree of life. You can stick this leaf anywhere and it will grow. All you got to throw the water in it. I have to know. I used to keep one every time. It looks like a fat iceberg leaf. You ever seen iceberg leaf? The plant they call the iceberg. It's fat and juicy. And you take just the leaf only and stick it in water, and throw the water, and it keeps growing by itself. It's called leaf of life. Find it in the tropical countries. In this country they have it too. Well, they said on this tree of leaf of life, there is a light shining on it. And that's the only one that is a genuine one. And it's on a mountain called Parbat. And that's way up in the Himalayas, or Himalayas. So, Hanuman volunteered to go for this leaf of life. And while he was going, he forgot to ask the bhikkhu or the priest what the leaf of life really looked like, except that there was a light atop the tree. How would he recognize it, the real one? Only by this light. In the meantime, Ravana was meditating, and he saw what was happening, and by his power of concentration, he caused all the trees on that mountain of Parbat to have a light. So when Hanuman arrived, he didn't know what to do, he was confused. He didn't know which was the tree of life now to pick this leaf. So then his devotion to God came out now. He says, my devotion must be so strong that I will move this mountain. If I have faith in God, I will move the mountain. That's where Jesus got actually was referring to that fact. You see, Jesus was a great master who came after many of the things that he spoke of, or many things that had happened in different cultures. He knew this had happened one time. Hanuman prayed so deeply and meditated so powerfully in meditation that the mountain started to vibrate. And in the vibration, the mountain lifted itself by telekinetic forces. It's not a very big mountain because you'll find out how it comes, where it is actually located. And it's moved by this telekinetic power of Hanuman. And it is traveling through the air right across Ayodhya, where Prince Bharat, who is then the Prince Regent ruling. Well, Prince Bharat, hearing this rumbling noise in the atmosphere, thought he was being invaded and thought it was a flying saucer. It looked like a flying saucer moving through the atmosphere. And according to the Ramayana, it was said that Hanuman went from Ceylon to the mountain Parbat in a rahat, for mana. Now, anyone who read Adamski's works, The Sources of Landed, the saucer has always been referred to as a Vimana. This is the word that the saucer people called it. If it, and this is strange, you find it in Sanskrit, it's been referred to as Dharahat Vamana. It was a flying vehicle powered by magnetic forces, powered by the mind. The flying saucers was not new to the Indian people. Our civilization is so old, you know. Now, this is part of the Ramayana, so it's deep science involved in it. So he flew in this thing from one spot to the other. And when he arrived, he was bringing this thing by telekinetic power, power of the mind. While he was passing over Ayodhya, Prince Bharat heard this noise and thought it was a flying saucer or something. And they say, Prince Bharat, this is written in the Ramayana, it's written, he ordered a such bomb to be fired into the air to bring down the object. Now sat is sound and bomb is unguided missile. It's a missile. It's like an arrow. In other words, if you literally translate it the way it would be, if you take it, if you read it, an arrow fired and controlled by sound. Now we know this is not, did not happen, and there was no way you can control an arrow by sound unless you're dealing in electronics or something. So this would have to be a missile, or what you call a sidewinder, that sought its objective through the sound frequencies and hit it. That's actually what it fired off. They fired a missile and hit the Vamana or the flying object of Hanuman and brought it down. When it landed, he saw this man in this object. And he told him that he was the Prince Bharat. He told him he was Hanuman, friend of the Prince Rama, whose brother Lakshman was dying, and he was going to lock in Parbat to get the leaf of life and take it off. Well, Bharat knew the leaf of life, and he reached out from the mountain Parbat. He pointed to him and he said, "Now keep your eye on that one. He didn't break it." He said, "Now I'm going to put you in his Sagandhan and transport you to my brother's location." Well, a Sagandhan is, again, an object that can move through space by the control of the human voice. So this man got in this object, and this thing has been held up by these magnetic forces, and by the voice of Bharat intoning certain words, he directed, like radio control, remote control, he guided him into the landing point and Ceylon. Strictly just directed to the point. He landed with this object and everything, and he handed it to the bhikkhu. He held it at the bhikkhu. The bhikkhu broke off the piece of leaf of life, rubbed it to save the life of Lakshman. Then the question came up. They won the battle. They killed Ravana. They were able to locate Ravana when he was praying. And they fought each other because Ravana realized he was losing. He had got up a fight. He broke his devotion and he got killed. But the question came up, what did Hanuman do with the mountain Parbat? If he really did move the mountain Parbat, if he did fly through the air across Ayodhya and he was then shot down, these are questions that were the logical mind asked, what did he do? He placed it on another mountain. He put one mountain on top of the other mountain and he called it Everest. Now, every man who have climbed Mount Everest will tell you it is not a single mountain. It's a double mountain. It comes up to the peak and gets a base wide out as a little hillock, the size of a hillock, and then starts going back. So they call it the extra peak of Everest. And that name has never changed since that time. No one knows why they call it Everest. It's called Mount Everest up to this day. If no man came along called it that name, there was no Englishman ever came and called it Everest. But this was the name that was left on that mountain, Mount Everest. And this is exactly where Hanuman left it. He lodged it there. And now when Jesus came along, he said, if you have faith in me, you will see under the mountain move and it will move. If you have this faith, like a grain of mustard seed. Now, a mustard seed is a pretty small thing. So he knew pretty well devotion was such a great thing that can bring this force into play. Now, if the same thing was true, that Rama knew devotion would have beaten Ravana. So when Bhimu brought them, opened the gate and let him go into the altar room where his brother was praying, his brother's deep in devotion, you know, and he saw what was happening, he realized that he was coming to the end of the rope. Because the spiritual vision was fading now. And he was challenged to get up and fight. Well, it was either he would stay there and not move from there and just keep on praying, or to get up and fight. Now, this is a challenge the ego faces. Which is greater? To be considered a coward, to sit down and keep on praying, or to exert your ego and get up and fight to prove the point? Which is the greater cowardice? See? Well, the greater cowardice was to get up and fight. Because he was not a coward if he had kept on praying, because Ravana couldn't kill him. I mean, Rama couldn't kill him then. It would be against all principle of human justice to kill a praying man. You see? And he was unarmed too. No. It's like in the old cowboys days, you know? Well, come on, that's how I shoot down now. Go shoot an unarmed man. It was against the code of the West to go shoot some unarmed people. So there was that. But ego got the better part of Ravana. And he got up from his devotion. And this is as Bhima says, you pray to the divine power, it's unbiased, but the only time it has the greatest chance to flow into a human being is by the power of that person's devotion. Now, Rama was so devoted to regain his wife, to his idealism, that he kept this pressure on. And Ravana, his ego got a better part of him. Instead of kept on praying, he got up to protect himself or defend the principle. You see? So he got killed. And that's how he got killed. But it's strange how, and after Sita was taken back, you know, then there's where Rama, the husband again, had the problem of man and wife. He wanted her to prove her faithfulness to him, if she was unfaithful to him while she was kidnapped. And through the trials of ordeal, she went through fire twice. And the third time she went back into the furrow where she was born, or where she came from. As I said, she was not born by man or woman. She was the result of 7 drops of blood from the great rishis. She dissolved her body form back. In other words, the rishis knew all this was going to happen when they gave up the 7 drops of blood. In other words, they got back their 7 drops of blood. Life was, you see, wherever they were, the 7 drops of blood got back into them. And it took that long time for this to come in. But it was compensated. That's why Jesus, if you understand the laws of what they're saying, your sins are forgiven you. And many things that they were talking, deep psychic forces were talking about, you know, just try to understand it. And the chant that remained years after when Rama lived, because he had 2 sons which he did not recognize when they were brought to him. And these were his own sons. The one was called Kus and the other was called Lankus, sons of the wolf. When Sita was in captivity, she was pregnant, you see, and she gave birth to these 2 sons during the battle. And to avoid them being killed by Ravana, she hid them in the forest while the armies were meeting for fighting. And after she was rescued in the compound of the Ravana's country, she never mentioned that these 2 sons were born to Rama. They were actually his 2 sons. Well, a wolf, a she-wolf, became the foster mother of these 2 kids. And they grew up among the wolves. And one day a great rishi was passing, and he saw this shivoli with these two kids. And he adopted these two kids into shivoli as his own children. And the world became like a household pet. And he taught those two sons the entire story of the life of Rama and Sita by word of mouth. Now this was his own guru of Rama. See, his guru didn't die. His guru taught him how to trick, the trick of how to use the bow and arrow, and he allowed him to lose his wife, and he come back. His guru went to the point of taking back his two sons to teach him the whole story of their life. So one day when Rama was an old man now, and all despondent, heartbroken because of his wife, and along came these two young boys chanting the life of Sita and Rama. And he was amazed, where did they know all the details of their lives in such minute details? And that's how the Ramayana, the song of Rama, it was written in the Ramayana. He chanted this thing, and he questioned these two kids. And he realized just then he got a heart attack that these were his own sons from his own wife's seat. It was too late then. And he passed on. But how karma works. He lived as an ideal husband. He lived to show how to obey the laws of life in his own life. And yet, how these things would work back. That all through the grace of the Guru. And when he did leave the body, actually, who did he meet? He met the Guru standing there. He had to live this particular cycle out. But then after he lived the cycle out, his Sita came back too, because the life principles never lost, because it was there too. But now the father of Sita is interesting. He was King Janak. And one day, he was in his courtyard, and there was a great sage by the name of Vyas Muni. Muni means monk. The monk Vyas, or Vyasa, some people pronounce it Vyasa. And he wrote the Bhagavad Gita, the story of Arjuna. Now, he had a son. When his wife was pregnant, when she was asleep, he waited till she was asleep. That was the origin of sleep education. He would talk to the wife under this somnambulistic state and educate the son in the womb. He taught the son the entire Bhagavad Gita by word of mouth while she was in that somnambulistic state, and taught the child. And when the child was born, at the age of 4, the child was able to repeat word for word, without even prompting, the entire Bhagavad Gita back to the father. And he realized his father was a great man. So when he got about 30 to 40 years of age, he said to his father, "Why don't you initiate me? You must be my guru." The father says, "No, I'm not your guru." No. Even though the father was a great master, see, he could not assume the responsibility of that soul. Each soul has a link to a particular master. We all will find when they come, if you see the link up. So he said, "No, your master is a king by the name of Janak. You go visit him." Well, here is this boy with all his books, you know, and he's all raring to go now. He's come from a very good family. He's a great father. He comes up to this King Janak's castle. And out in the courtyard, he sees King Janak. You know, somebody's fanning him. And he's a big flagon of wine. Long, big shirt, smoking, and enjoying the sunshine. And around him is dancing with some beautiful damsels and entertaining the king. And he's doing a family party, eating, talking. So the kid looks and he says, that's my guru. This guy is going to be my guru. My father must be nuts. What can he teach me?